This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This is audio from a San Antonio police officer's body camera obtained by the Texas Observer. On April 19, 2015, police were called to the home of Noble and Jennifer Cooper to help deal with their adult son, Norman. Norman was having some type of episode. He was highly excited, pacing back and forth, shouting about Jesus and the gospel. 11 minutes after police arrived, Norman Cooper was hit with his first of 9 stun gun charges. Cooper's heart then stopped. Emergency medical techs were unable to restart it. In the course of an hour from the time of the family's call to 911, Norman Cooper was pronounced dead. An officer at the scene said the cause of death was excited delirium. Later, it was found that Norman Cooper did have meth in his system. Excited delirium syndrome is controversial. It's not recognized by the American Medical Association, but coroners use it as a cause of death, and police departments rely on it to explain why some suspects die in their custody. According to an investigation by the Austin American-Statesman newspaper, many deaths in Texas police custody attributed to excited delirium are in a medical and legal gray zone. The American Statesman's investigation into Texas non-shooting deaths of persons in police custody since 2005 reveals that excited delirium as an official cause of death is common in Texas. More than 1 in 6 of the 289 such deaths have been attributed to excited delirium. In many of the 50 cases, subjects died after violent, extended struggles with police. 14 were shocked by tasers before they died. Vincent DeMaio, a former San Antonio medical examiner, is one of the biggest defenders of excited delirium. He literally wrote the book on it. In 2006, he published a widely cited textbook on excited delirium, co-authored with his wife, who is a forensic nurse. Here is DeMaio speaking to NJ.com.
They described as having superhuman strength. You can taser them, you can hit them, and it doesn't seem to bother them. They still keep going. You call the police, and the police have to restrain them because they're a danger not only to others, but a danger to themselves. They'll go running through traffic. The police know. They know it's a medical emergency. And so the police try to talk them down, and sometimes it works. Many times it doesn't. And then they get into a struggle. And the longer they struggle, the worse it is and the greater probability that death will occur. When you've got a case that appears to be excited delirium, whether it's drugs or whether it's psychiatric, get them to the hospital immediately.
Dr. Douglas P. Zipes, a nationally recognized cardiologist and expert on sudden death, says he is skeptical of the vague, unscientific, catch-all excited delirium diagnosis. Here he is with NJ.com.
Can an individual be excited and delirious when having an in-custody confinement? Well, of course. So that broad nature absolutely happens. Do individuals on occasion die in custody unrelated to being hit on the head or a taser or something like that? Absolutely, they do. That said, that's excited delirium. Now, within that, there's a constellation of potential mechanisms. It's an empty big bag of diagnoses that doesn't establish how someone actually died. That his hands were handcuffed behind him, his legs were shackled, the bleeding that he suffered, the bleeding into his lungs, the fractured ribs. I think a respiratory death is just as reasonable or even more reasonable than excited delirium.
Michael Barajas is a reporter for the Texas Observer and has written an article called Excited Delirious Dead. Is excited delirium syndrome a medical phenomenon or a convenient cover for deaths in police custody?
You know, some of the experts that I speak to that are critical of the syndrome that think it's either a controversial medical theory at best, or, you know, at worst, it's, you know, theory that's been stretched and applied to a number of cases, just wherever police might look for an alternative explanation for why somebody died in custody. You know, the reason we even have a count on it now is because Texas has in recent years, like some other states, forced some sort of reporting requirements for law enforcement agencies. So now, you know, custodial deaths for police departments, for all law enforcement agencies, you know, those are things that are reported to the Texas Attorney General now. I cite, you know, I think the Austin American Statesman has been doing some pretty good work on this stuff, just crunching the numbers and looking at what's been submitted to the AG's office so far. And that's where that 50 number comes from. But you know, some of the experts that look at this, they say that might be sort of an undercount, just because of how this diagnosis is applied in practice. The case of Norman Cooper that I look at, that wasn't a diagnosis that was officially applied to his case until it became a lawsuit, and until it was, you know, used in court sort of as an explanation for why this man died, instead of the actions police took that night. But as I put in the story, and as you can hear on some of the audio taken from the scene, you know, it's a pretty common thing in law enforcement circles. One of the investigators on hand that night even sort of mentioned it as a possible explanation the night that Norman Cooper died.
You can tell right away he's freaking out of it.
Well, and I asked him why. I could tell he was sweaty. He was so sweaty, and he didn't have his shirt on. And
that's quite a delirium.
I went on YouTube and I found multiple videos that were recorded by law enforcement agencies basically explaining how to use the term excited delirium as a defense.
The first time I ever had this mentioned to me was a police academy, you know, training director that I was interviewing for another story, and sort of mentioned this medical phenomenon where people might die in police custody, but it wasn't the fault of police officers, that it was just they were on drugs and they went crazy and they just suddenly died. You know, not an overdose. Drugs in the system weren't at levels that doctors or medical examiners would characterize it as an overdose, but that, you know, they just, their brain went haywire and they died. And so, you know, I've heard this brought up before, but I think the case of Norman Cooper sort of shows a little bit more explicitly how this diagnosis is applied in practice. And, you know, maybe what kind of questions get glossed over when it's applied this way. I cite one of the doctors that looked at the case for the Cooper family that, you know, he thinks that there are multiple problems with the police response that night. Could have averted death in this case.
So the question is, when the police have an individual in custody, and that person is in a hyperstate of arousal, loud, and they're acting out, and then the police respond to that with tasers or with a dog pile or whatever they're doing, chokeholds, and that person dies, the police are able to say, this was not our responsibility, this was not our fault because of excited delirium. And Is there a consistent method of trying to establish whether or not there is excited delirium?
I mean, that sort of hits at the, like, I think the confusion that this has caused, even when, like, courts have looked at this. I cite another case where when the judge dismissed the lawsuit from a family member who died in police custody, that it, you know, effectively it muddies the waters enough to where, you know, it's hard to pinpoint exactly what killed somebody. So you're right. These are cases where it's not like a simple shooting case. It's usually after a pretty intense police struggle or some sort of police struggle where somebody might be on the ground. Somebody might be, as in the case of Norman Cooper, hit with stun guns, where there are drugs involved. Maybe there's an underlying heart condition that was exacerbated by a lot of this. You know, there might be a number of factors, but no single, simple, easy way to pinpoint what caused somebody's death. You know, what some of the, you know, experts that challenge the way excited delirium has been used, you know, what they say is that you should look at these law enforcement techniques and question, you know, whether you should tase somebody who's under the influence of drugs that you know is under the influence of drugs, whether you should hold somebody in some of these stress positions or on the ground, whether you should respond to somebody differently if you're afraid they might die, basically, based on these symptoms that we know people tend, or not everybody, but some people tend to die after an intense police encounter when others don't. So yeah, what they're afraid of, you know, the experts on the other side are telling me is that they're afraid, you know, police won't take as seriously policies and procedures that tell them not to tase people or use stun guns on them when they're under the influence of drugs. You know, the San Antonio Police Department passed a reform in 2008, you know, a policy saying that, you know, from newspaper accounts at the time, you know, the police chief even mentioned the six-sided delirium diagnosis as, you know, we know that these people, for some reason, are dying after law enforcement encounters. And, you know, if this is a way to prevent that, you know, this is our new policy. That wasn't followed in the case of Norman Cooper. And after he died, that policy was actually tweaked so that officers apparently won't be disciplined for tasing people under the influence of drugs. So, yeah, I think the people that would question the validity of this diagnosis or question at least how it's applied and what cases it's applied, they seem to be concerned that other police actions won't be questioned or evaluated when somebody dies because of this rather simple explanation.
So the police officers say that when someone is using these products like bath salts or synthetic cannabinoid like Kush or other drugs, meth, that the individual is exhibiting superhuman strength and they don't feel pain. They are also acting out violently and are in the process of hurting themselves or hurting others, and that they have to resort to using tasers or any other methods that they have in order to restrain this individual, and that things have already gone beyond the point where de-escalation is an option.
Right.
And that's how they describe the presentation of excited delirium.
Right. And from that vantage point, I mean, you can see the sort of catch-22 situation that police officers would be put in. That, you know, for a variety of reasons, they're the ones that are encountering people that are in other psychiatric crisis or people that have, you know, substance abuse problems or that are, you know, on drugs. Or, I mean, we most often hear about these cases. It's usually somebody on either meth or cocaine seems to be most often the drugs that people are on when excited delirium is brought up. But yeah, the description is somebody who where de-escalation techniques won't work, where a police response or you know, sort of intense police encounter is bound to happen no matter what because of the behavior somebody's exhibiting. And so the rub there, how you train officers to appropriately respond to a syndrome that in effect they're told is already fatal by the time they recognize its symptom.
But then officers have that knowledge that by claiming excited delirium, that if the suspect in their custody dies, they're not going to be held liable. And does that impact their choices that they make?
I think that's a good question. I think that's a question I would love someone at the San Antonio Police Department to answer.
The concept of excited delirium is very controversial, and there are experts who say it doesn't actually exist. It's not a recognized syndrome by the American Medical Association.
There are some people that question the validity of the diagnosis itself. And then there are others that, you know, they think maybe there is something like this, that it's really rare or that it's a distinct psychiatric condition, or you know, there are some experts that say this is a neurological, it's a genetic thing, that for some people their brains just react this way on drugs when you add, you know, an intense sort of police struggle. Most experts, they seem to have a problem with, one, is it real or not? But two, even if it is real, how is it being applied in these cases? And they think it's being stretched to cover police actions that should be scrutinized.
Do you think that the public would be better served by having a better understanding of excited delirium, that if the general population was aware that this is a controversial concept that's being used by law enforcement, knowing about this, people would ask more questions?
Yeah, I certainly think it would make people ask questions. In the textbook that Vince DiMaio wrote, I mean, he lists a number of different types of police scenarios where he would urge medical examiners and police officials to consider a diagnosis of excited delirium, like when somebody dies after being, you know, put in a chokehold or having been, you know, subject to pepper spray or something like that, or, you know, certain stress positions or rubber bullets or, you know, stun guns or tasers or any of those types of intense police encounters. I think just knowing that that's the way police evaluate and look at how those types of deaths occur, maybe if people know that that's how police are explaining it.
Michael Barajas is a reporter for the Texas Observer and has written the article, Excited, Delirious, Dead. Is excited delirium syndrome a medical phenomenon or a convenient cover for deaths in police custody? You can read the article online on their website, texasobserver.org. The fantasy of Texas national independence has been stoked for decades, but in recent years it's found an ally with Russia. An investigation into a popular pro-Texas secession Facebook page found that it was run by Russians. The Heart of Texas Facebook page was operated by a troll factory called the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, Russia, with the intent to juice right-wing paranoia. The page was populated with posts of fake news and grammatically flawed diatribes against illegal immigration, refugees, Islamophobia, and there were rants against Hillary Clinton and imaginary voter fraud. The Heart of Texas Facebook page had some 249,000 likes shortly before it was suspended. Casey Michel is a reporter for Think Progress and has been tracking Russian efforts to fuel secession campaigns in Texas and around the world.
The Heart of Texas, which is revealed to be Russian, really played up. This plenty of the posts and the memes that they had on that site were all about Texas independence. Texans don't need anyone else telling them what to do, where to go, how to live their lives. Therefore, we should be an independent country, break free from Washington, break free from the other states. All the while, this is, again, a foreign-run website pushing this. That's not to say they were necessarily pulling all of the strings. Again, those Texas separatists on the ground in Texas, they have their own agency. They have their own decisions that they made on their own end. But as we saw with this Heart of Texas page, there were even rallies and protests organized by this Russian Heart of Texas page that people turned out for. One of them was in Houston, protesting an Islamic center, brought out plenty of people, about 100 people total in terms of protesters and counter-demonstrators, some of whom were armed with AR-15s. It was serious stuff. You can laugh about the typos and the bizarre grammar on the site, but at the end of the day, it is serious.
How do we know for sure that the Heart of Texas Facebook page and It's Time to Secede Twitter feed were orchestrated by the Russians?
So my reporting led me to believe that at the end of the day, these were operations and pages run out of Russia. All the indicators were there, both in terms of the timing of their setup, both in terms of the messaging they pushed, as well as, again, these bizarre typos and grammar that they pushed. Having studied the Russian language at university, I was familiar with the Russian grammatical structure, and it's pretty clear they just put the words there without paying much attention to the actual grammar. So that my research pointed to all signs, again, being that this is Russian. We saw that Facebook and Twitter took down these hundreds of accounts. They linked to those in Russia. There were reporters at Business Insider and in CNN who had sources inside Facebook and Twitter saying, yes, these were Russian operations. This Heart of Texas page was run out of St. Petersburg, Russia. There was confirmation from sources inside Facebook. We're able to track back the payments for these ads that were the kind of initial look at or revelation behind these links to Russia.
And is it something different to say that the Kremlin was involved?
Yeah, that's a great question, David. There are any number of questions surrounding that have yet to be revealed. And part of the reason that we don't have as many answers as we probably should by now is that Facebook and Twitter and Instagram are holding all the information themselves. They are keeping their cards close to the chest. They say they're being transparent, but they're not responding to journalists. They're not responding to researchers. So we don't know exactly who their contact was. We don't know exactly who or how many individuals were running these accounts. There are indications that it may have been some kind of independent or semi-independent organization that was putting these out there. But as with many things in Russia, especially as it pertains to foreign policy, and in this case, foreign meddling, the likelihood is that there are actors within the Kremlin who are certainly aware of it, maybe not necessarily Vladimir Putin himself, but certainly higher-ups who are looking for avenues to sow chaos and dissent in the U.S. and then take that project, present it to Putin as fait accompli or a successful operation, and say, yes, we'd like more funding, we'd like to expand this going forward.
Now, we have policies being made in Texas that some say have links to the momentum created by these Russian Facebook pages and websites. One of them was the reaction to the Jade Helm exercise, where Governor Greg Abbott ordered the State Guard to monitor the U.S. Army as they did this exercise. And the other one was the creation of these Texas gold depository, which was something that the Texas Nationalist Movement said that they were responsible for, and which is supposed to be kind of like a Texas Fort Knox, where Texans can put their gold in and keep it safe.
Right.
And no other state has anything like this, and this is brand new in Texas. So this is not a benign, inert type of a movement. We're seeing it actually having effect on policies being crafted in Texas.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Dave. You know, you followed the Texas separatist movement longer than I have. You saw how it grew under the previous administration, grew this momentum on the ground operations, on the ground networking. They were able to find a foreign benefactor in Russia to help support them, to fly them over to Moscow, to coordinate and swap tactics with other Western secession movements, some of whom are in the U.S., in Hawaii, in Puerto Rico, in California. But as you said, the separatist movement and sentiment in Texas is far greater and far more structured and has had a far greater impact than any other state in the U.S. To your point about Jade Helm and the gold depositories, the Russian state media played that up as much as anything. In 2015, when Jade Helm was going on, there was a host on the RT Russian state media channel who said that this means that there is a civil war looming in the U.S. Not here, but it is coming. This is what they pointed to. This is what they hyped up. These tensions that already existed. Again, Texas separatism, Texas nationalism didn't generate in Russia, but this was a tension and an existing movement that Russian actors and Russian operatives saw fit to increase and to exacerbate through actions like flying them over to Russia or creating these fake Facebook pages, Heart of Texas, again, being the most popular Texas secession page on Facebook.
About 10 years ago, I remember reading about a Russian political scientist who predicted that by 2050 that the United States would break up. And at the time, people looked at that prediction as humorous and as just not to be taken seriously. But were there people in Russia that did take that seriously and saw that steps could be taken in order to make that prediction a reality?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, it's easy to laugh at these kind of fringe movements, these ideas that secession from the U.S. is feasible. You know, as Antonin Scalia said, you know, the Civil War effectively ended that argument. And obviously, in Texas v. White, we saw that it remained illegal for a state to secede, even if they vote on it. That said, there are actors in Russia, one of whom you just brought up, Igor Panarin, who was a social scientist who predicted, again, the breakup of the U.S. into a, I don't know, it was a half dozen or eight or nine separate nations. And I really think that caught on in certain circles. Otherwise, they wouldn't be encouraging movements like the Texas secessionists or other secessionists here in the U.S. Obviously, Texas secession isn't going to succeed in the near-term future, but there is certainly a network being constructed both domestically as well as internationally, looking to movements that we've seen in Catalonia or you know, for that matter, South Sudan, or even as it plays to Russian ears, Eastern Ukraine. That would be music to the Kremlin's ears, and in Crimea. It's a movement and an organization and a network that we do a disservice to ignore, and it's not going away anytime soon.
And even if the full vision is not realized of a breaking up of the United States, it's just the fact that if you're able to help foster a movement and get people believing in it and working towards that, that's enough to cause static in the internal politics of the United States that would take pressure off of foreign policies, which would benefit Russia.
Absolutely. That's 100% correct. And even beyond that, if they don't eventually see a state succeed in seceding, if they don't eventually see any kind of breakup of the U.S., they were still organizing protests in cities like Houston that saw some of the protesters bringing AR-15. As we saw it play out in Charlottesville, we can no longer take for granted that these protests between white nationalists, white supremacists, and counter-demonstrators are going to end peacefully. And all it takes is for one or two incidents with one or two AR-15s from one or two protesters that are organized by Facebook pages that are run by Russian operatives for things to go bad and things to escalate very, very quickly thereafter.
So where do you see this going? Do you think that by making people aware that Russia wants to see this happen, that they have put resources behind these Facebook pages and hired people to create memes and do all this work, is that going to inoculate us against their interference?
You know, there's a phrase that's bandied about a lot within the Russian studies and broader Russian coverage sphere that Vladimir Putin is a masterful tactician, but a horrible strategist. And I think that if we are lucky, this is one of those instances in which the tactics we saw at play were very successful in terms of turning people out, in terms of gaining followers, in terms of gaining information. But once they were found out, it seems as if he or whichever Russian operatives they may have been overplayed their hands. Now we have policymakers in Washington who are far more keen to retain the sanctions, no matter what the Trump administration or the president may want, retain the sanctions on Russia. Those aren't going to be lifted anytime soon. The U.S. isn't going to recognize Crimea anytime soon. Whatever momentum the Kremlin may have found from the election in November has effectively dissipated. That said, I don't know where things go from here. I don't know what Trump is going to tweet tomorrow. I don't know what is going to happen with these investigations that are ongoing. There are so many variables at play right now, one of them being the increasing salience of and support for secession movements in the U.S. from foreign actors.
I don't see anyone trying to mount a counter public relations campaign trying to lay out that if you're talking about secession, you are a traitor. It is un-American.
Right.
You know, of all these states working together, has been the most successful nation in the history of the world. Why would
right.
we want to mess that up?
You're exactly right. I don't know where that PR campaign, I don't know where that messaging is going to come from. I think as the increasing reportage comes out, more and more people will be aware that there are actors outside of the U.S., adversaries, who are interested in breaking up the U.S., and I think that as more and more people, or I have to think that as more and more people are aware, there is a commensurate increase of more and more people who are pushing back against these separatists, pushing back against these secessionists. Maybe their heart is in the right place in terms of the secessionists. Maybe they do want, at the end of the day, simply a betterment for themselves and their families, but the means and the ends with which they're going about it is completely backwards. Absolutely.
Casey Michel is a reporter for Think Progress and has been tracking Russian efforts to fuel secession campaigns in Texas and around the world. We have a link to his reporting on our website, tpr.org. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.